this is ridiculous. The last thing I want is for you to sit here feeling resentful.
Well, as you pointed out, we don't always get what we want.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This Melrose Place. I'm Don Pardo, apparently. This is Melrose Place. Season 5, Episode 10. Nice work if you can get it. And now, here are your hosts.
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Hi, Tara. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Quick announcement before we get into this episode. Again with this episode 95. Can you believe it? Dropping May 13th. Let's watch Jenny Garth and Tori Spelling, among others, in MasterChef Celebrity Family Showdown. The fact that this is only available on Daily Motion should probably give me some pause. It did not. We will be talking all about it. You can find that episode and all of our other Patreon episodes at patreon.com/againwiththis. Any level of support gets you all those extra episodes. Please join us. We have a delightful time talking about some detestable television.
Sometimes it's good.
Yeah, sometimes it is good.
This probably won't be, but we'll see.
This will not be one of those times. Spoiler.
Let's start with our D plot for this episode. Nice work if you can get it. Will Allison and Jake become business partners? This hardly rises to the level of a plot. It is one scene. The first time we see these two boobs is at 21 and 40 something time code. But they're in Jake's office as he hands Allison a deed to the bar. She is now officially its half owner. She doesn't really look happy, as she says she thought he was kidding when he offered that before. And they have this exchange, clip 2.
Why'd you do this?
Seemed like the perfect solution. Just makes you more than a waitress and less than an ad exec. Did I do something wrong?
It's not that I'm not touched. But you don't really think you can make this kind of career decision for me, do you?
You've always told me how happy you are here, that you're a hell of a lot happier here than you ever were at D&D.
I am happier. For now. But I never said forever.
Oh. What am I supposed to do with this joint deed? Just throw it away. I'll get my lawyer to reverse it. Just forget it.
No. I just need some time to think about it.
Ah, no bother. You don't want to be a bar owner. You would be a waste of that college degree.
Oh, yeah. College degree is real fucking valuable.
Yeah. Also, why make this about, like, the class struggle in non-Beverly Hills when what it's actually about is, like, that's a huge amount of responsibility and you guys aren't married. I mean, mm-hmm. even in the show's timeline, you've been together for 14 or 15 days.
Well, like it's hard to say because in the last episode, Amanda said it's been 6 months. So I think they've just decided, like, the same amount of time has elapsed since the finale, between the finale and the present.
Sure.
Right?
Okay. So, but still. 6 months and you're going to give her half the bar?
Yeah. Also, like, I don't think anyone thinks Jake is struggling, but we haven't really seen any evidence that, like, he's making enough bank from this enterprise that he can afford to give half of it away.
Yeah, especially since every single storyline involving shooters before Allison got there was how badly he sucked
right.
at running his own business and
yes.
how his girlfriends always had to bail him out and or embezzle money from the super scary computer that he didn't know
yeah.
how to use.
Yes.
Shelley, who I guess ran off with Chris to Terminal Island. Anyway.
Sure. Yeah, anyway. That's it for them. So hope you enjoyed that. On to the C plot, which also barely counts as a plot. Mm. Matt finally gets Dr. Dan in the sack. Dan is getting a continental breakfast ready in his large kitchen when Matt enters buttoning his shirt so that we know they have had some extremely off-screen sex and they both feel good about it. Waking up next to Matt felt to Dan as though Matt were living there already, and Matt agrees. Finally, they are an item, so how would Matt...
An item! Okay, who wrote this? My dad. Hilarious.
Anyway.
Oh, who wrote this?
Now that they are.
Are they also each other's main squeeze? That's mm-hmm. how you know Dave Sr. really wrote it.
Matt, it is his beau. That's my mother's word.
Oh, that's cute.
Given that they now are an item and one another's main squeezes, how would Matt like to be Dan's date to a black tie event tomorrow? Matt would love it if he can get a tuxedo in time, and Dan happens to have one for him already. This is the first time in forever that Dan hasn't had to go stag, and Matt says if he plays his cards right, he'll never have to go stag again. Slow your roll. It's been one night.
Really? I mean, here's the other thing, though. My notes literally read, tux equals Bluebeard sitch?
Yeah. Completely.
I feel like there's a whole bunch of Matt's bad Ronalding around in the basement of Dr. Dan's house. Like, what can they do? They've done the married thing. They've done the set him up thing. They've done the HIV positive partner who can't cope thing. What else is there?
Nothing.
Bluebeard.
Those are all the plots. Those are all the classic plots. So we don't see them again until they're leaving the event, which, by the way, is way more than one night later based on the progress of the episode's other plot lines. But anyway, Matt's grateful for the gift of the tuxedo and wonders if they may stay at his place that night because it's closer to his early shift the next day. But Dan doesn't know why leaving from his place would be a problem, which, like, he can't wear a tuxedo to work is one. Matt doesn't say that. That's me. But Dan persists. Doesn't Matt think Dan's place is more comfortable? And Matt can't argue that, so it's settled. Controlling much? Let's keep an eye on this.
That's fine. It's fine. He's right.
You're right.
He's fine. It's fine.
You're right.
No blue, no beard, nothing. It's fine.
Oh my God, we're already at the B plot. One Mancini gets news, the other will have to wait. In Chicago, Jane gets out of a cab at her parents' house. They are both overjoyed to see her, but start right in immediately with their hopes that Jane is going to move back there. Jane's hometown friends also hope she will, according to her mother, who says they call her parents all the time to say so, which is weird. Like, call Jane.
Yeah, what?
If you're friends. Anyway, Jane returns to her childhood bedroom, which apparently has been kept as a shrine to her, and is fondling a Dumbled doll when Mrs. Andrews enters. Sydney already called her to say that Jane had been having some problems, which, like, pick your spot, Sydney. Tell Amanda some shit. Don't tell your mom about Jane.
Yeah.
But Jane's voice breaks as she says she's made a mess of her life and she wishes she could start over. And Mrs. Andrews says she can in Chicago. They could help her find an apartment. Mr. Andrews might even be able to help her get her a job. But enough about Jane. How's Mrs. Andrews? Fine, just fine. But Jane thinks she looks pale. So Mrs. Andrews admits she's having her gallbladder removed in a few days, but it's totally no big deal. And there's some sexist nonsense about Mr. Andrews needing Jane to stay around and look after him during Mrs. Andrews' recovery, like he can't make himself a friggin' sandwich. But Jane just smiles that she seems to have come home at the right time. Back in L.A., Michael rings the bell at his mistress's house. Seems like he should have his own key, but what do I know about such arrangements? Nothing. Megan comes to the door in a robe, and he immediately asks why it took her so long to answer. She says she was taking a bath. Michael will have to get her a louder buzzer. He has brought her the checkbook, an ATM card, for the bank account he just opened for her, and says he'll make deposits twice a month of whatever he can afford.
No.
I don't like this level of financial security for her. Also, what about her parents?
Yeah. Also, doesn't he still have medical school loans? Like,
yeah. Also, she has a bank account, which is presumably already set up for shady transactions. So just deposit the money there. She doesn't need a new account, but whatever.
Yeah.
There's also a credit card on its way and a cell phone for her. So she's never out of reach for him. And we're supposed to think she didn't have a cell phone before as a call girl in Los Angeles in the mid, late
as if
90s. But anyway, clip three.
Like, I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but this is getting to be way too much. I mean, I feel like every aspect of my life is being controlled by someone else.
You know what the problem here is? You've never had anybody look after you before. So it scares you, but it shouldn't. Because I care, Megan. And there's safety in that.
You know, sometimes you actually convince me that it's possible to change my life.
Oh, it's not only possible. It's a done deal.
You're now a prisoner of a stalker.
Yeah.
Done deal indeed.
Use that cell phone to call Matt and start comparing notes because I don't like any of this. But
yeah, I don't either.
They are kissing on it, but then the door bursts open and Kimberly enters aghast. Clip 4.
Oh my God.
Oh. Kimberly, wait. Wait. Will you calm down? It's not as bad as it looks.
Do this.
Well, look, just calm down. Let me explain. Oh,
keep your dirty hands off of me. I will never stop hating you for this, Michael. Never.
But Kimberly, wait. Come.
That was your wife, I take it.
Yeah. Good guess.
No, it's my sister. Weird, right? Anywho, the next day, Jane escorts Mrs. Andrews to a medical appointment. Because Jane is on a soap, she waits for Mrs. Andrews to leave with the nurse before asking the doctor privately how serious the operation actually is. It's a simple procedure. Her health is good otherwise, but she does have a rare blood type, so would Jane be comfortable donating some of hers? And of course she will, but when the nurse looks all of their blood types up, they learn, in case you're writing a book, Mrs. Andrews is AB negative, Mr. Andrews is A negative, and Jane is O positive. Mm. The nurse thinks it must be a clerical error. Jane wonders why their blood types wouldn't match, and the nurse is in the middle of saying they should when Mrs. Andrews comes tearing out from the back to pull Jane away because the doctor told her about all this blood business, and long story short, Jane's adopted. Ba-ba-ba. Very abrupt. Back in L.A., Michael comes home to find Kimberly quietly reading. He expected fireworks or his bags at the door, but she wasn't about to pack for him, so he should come get his shit when she's not there.
Queen.
He did her a favor. She doesn't have to try and protect his feelings anymore, and he's like, what does that mean? And then regrets asking. Clip 5.
I'm only frigid with you, Michael.
Oh, come on. I don't buy that. You're lashing out because I betrayed you, and I'm sorry I did that. But you can't say you don't love me. Not when you know I still love you. Because I do.
It doesn't matter anymore, Michael, because I don't want you in my life.
You're lying. Now, I want you to look me in the eye and tell me you don't love me. Come on! Look me in the eyes and tell me!
Not only do I not love you, I haven't liked you in a very long time.
I don't believe you. Like, no way! I don't believe this!
Because it's the most honest thing I've said in months.
Well, then you're right. I did the right thing by having an affair. You hear me? That was the right thing.
So, as he storms out, she cries. And this is exactly like the end of Harry and the Hendersons in every way. Just wanted to note that.
love that comp. Gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
Sometime later, Mr. Andrews finds Jane moping at a table outside and says, this is still her home. And she's like, is it? And he's like, yes.
We raised you, so.
Right. Ugh,
whatever. This could be worse, actually, in the way it talks about these things, but it could be better.
Yes. So it turns out they adopted her because they thought at the time that they had fertility issues, but found out otherwise when Mrs. Andrews conceived Sydney. And this is why they never told Jane. They didn't want her to feel different from her sister. They don't know much about Jane's biological parents, except that her mother was single. But if Jane wants to try to find her, she should. Back at the beach house, Megan shows up so that Kimberly can map out the strategy for phase 2 of their plan. She has a folder open in front of her. It's all very, like, seriously formal.
I know. I was a little disappointed there wasn't, like, a PowerPoint or, like, a rolling, like, the chalk talk.
Right, right.
Whiteboard.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it would be a PowerPoint deck if this were happening today, for sure. But regardless, clip 6.
So we could go over my finances. Why would I need to know about your finances? For your peace of mind. Now, I've made out a will leaving everything to Michael, so when you marry him, it'll be yours to share. Wait a minute, this is crazy. You never said anything about marrying Michael. But you said you loved him. I do, but I don't want a marriage based on a lie. What difference does it make as long as the outcome is good? The difference is I will never know how he really feels about me. Look, this could all be a house of cards once he finds out that you paid me. But he's never going to know because neither one of us is ever going to tell him. But I can't live with the lies forever, okay? I can barely live with it now. Like, I have to tell him. I have to. Like, it's the only way I'll ever know. No, you can't. You'll ruin everything,
no.
Megan.
I'm sorry.
Megan!
Now she's Johnny Truth? Like, what the fuck? I don't get this.
Yeah. Also, he's just going to, like, the minute you're married, he's going to cheat on you with someone else.
Absolutely.
So. Probably Taylor, who was a creep. So, yeah, I once again, this is taking, it feels like a third or a half again as long as it should.
Yep.
To get to the fireworks factory, but.
Yeah, but it's because the season is a third or a half again as long as it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Starverse.
So Megan comes back to her place to find Michael eating a sandwich, but there's no time for his delicious lunch right now. She's got some truth to dish out. But before she can say anything, Kimberly comes running in after her and blurts that she wants a divorce, and Michael is like, okay. She leaves. Megan tells Michael to go after her. He will obviously never love Megan like he loves Kimberly, but he tells her things happen for a reason, the way Megan showed up in his life, and when. That's fate. So if Kimberly doesn't want him anymore, he's free to love Megan, and her response is to kiss him, so I guess she's fine with it. And back in Chicago by night, Jane is at a church talking to a nun from the order that handled her adoption. Her birth surname was Larson, but she wasn't given a first name. Her birthday is March 24th, 1969, for anyone writing a book. Nice.
Nice.
Her father's unknown, but her mother's name is Sherry Larson, and she lives in Los Angeles. And Jane is way too excited about the coincidence, so this nun has to tell her that she may have moved sometime in the past 27 years.
And also that Los Angeles has millions and millions of people in it.
Named Larson alone are probably hundreds of thousands, but anyway.
Yeah.
The nun also cautions that Jane should not let her zeal to connect with her biological mother alienate her from her adoptive parents, which is good advice that we'll see if Jane takes it, I suppose.
I mean, it's Jane, so I doubt it.
Right.
Whoever gave her advice about her hair recently, oof.
Finally, our A-plot, Taylor's scheming has expected consequences and Craig's moving on up. Taylor and Kyle are having morning sex in their weird bed. Please go to the visual aids and look at this headboard because I can't even really describe it. It's like a Cupid's bow shape, but it's so much wider than the mattress. It's a real scene.
Yeah, and there's not even a microwave in it. Come on, guys.
But when he rolls off, because he can tell she's not into it, she says it's hard to make love to someone who doesn't respect you. And Kyle is dismayed that they're about to talk about Peter again, and she snits that if he doesn't trust her to choose her own friends, of course they're going to have issues with intimacy. And Kyle counters that she needs to act like an adult and not the college student he dragged kicking and screaming into adulthood. Okay, I think you kind of just proved her point about not respecting her.
Yeah, is this like a Kyle heel turn that we're in the middle of right now?
Because I don't know.
Yeah, and this is not Estes's strength, being a dick.
Yeah.
He's like too pretty for that. But anyway.
She snaps that she's her own person. He didn't create her and she can spend time with whoever she wants. And as she storms out, he follows to say that being married means they compromise. And Taylor sneers that this must be why he compromised their marriage in Boston, which, like, you walked right into that one, Kyle.
Yeah.
And he shrugs that she brings it up so much, he might as well just cheat on her again, which, like, keep digging, bro. So she leaves the apartment.
But, yeah, kind of. Like, you're being a creep. Bluff called.
For real.
Stop bringing it up.
Mm-hmm. In the courtyard, a pajama-clad Peter's heading back home with the paper to see that Amanda's already dressed and on her way out. She's back in a pantsuit and flats. Black, not as good as red, but, you know, I'm interested in seeing how she's shaking it up.
In the visual aids, Tara expressed that this was not her favorite. I thought it was great, except for the flat shoes.
Mm.
Needed a black Chuck Taylor, in my opinion, but I like the turtleneck on her.
She could do that now. Then it would have been weird, but yes. So he was hoping they could have breakfast so he could tell her all about being up for the chief of staff job at the hospital, which, like, didn't you see each other last night? But she's delighted to hear about it and tells him not to feel any guilt about ruining Michael's chances. And as soon as Amanda's left, Taylor comes down. Peter says hi. Taylor looks like she wants to jump on him, but she says she's in a hurry. He is too. And upstairs, Kyle parts the blinds to glare, which you can see in the visual aids, of course. So Amanda makes it to a D&D staff meeting exactly on time since she can count on the old man being 5 minutes late. But Arthur is not the one who called the meeting. It was Craig, and here he is. And Amanda challenges his authority, reminding him that he's supposed to be an office assistant. Really? Because in the last episode, he was Billy's boss, but okay. But He tells her and everyone else that he just gained a controlling interest in D&D. Hmm. Debatable. And plans to take charge of the company's day-to-day operations, which... This is the maybe, I don't want to say anything is the most business thing ever, but like when we thought that was Arthur, he didn't do this. He wasn't in the office every day being the president.
He also wasn't using phrasings like anyone under my staff.
Yes.
Like here again. It's fine if it's business. In fact, it's quite entertaining. But could it not also be this ESL translation of stereo instructions? Because now I don't know what is ignorance and what is just people being in a hurry.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really care either way. The idea that someone who looks like David Charvet would have a controlling interest in anything except a surf shack is bonkers. So whatever. Uh-huh.
I was going to say picnic basket, so you have more trust in him than I do.
I do.
Amanda says she expects Arthur to continue supervising, but Craig announces that Arthur's no longer involved with the company, and Craig doesn't want anyone there to communicate with Arthur anymore, and Amanda looks appropriately sick at this. So Craig stops her and Billy on their way out to say he will need to rely on them both during this transition, which, like, pretty sure you can skip Billy's advice. But Craig knows how Amanda felt about his dad and how shitty Arthur was to her, but he thinks Amanda's great. And as soon as he's gone, Billy and Amanda both agree that no matter what he says, Craig is bad news. So Billy comes into Jane's place to see Sam in the living room working on a large painting of the courtyard. Billy, the wordsmith for a living, has no comment on her work except the colors are nice. And then Craig smarms in and compliments its composition and colors, but maybe it's too bright, suggesting a falseness in the image, the darkness beneath the facade. And Sam's impressed that Craig got all that while Billy makes a new idiot face. And Craig says he minored in art history. I assume this is another thing about Daniel Cosgrove's character, Matt from 90210, where, like, does Wharton even have an art history department?
College.
Yeah.
The pride of Hamilton Law, folks.
Hamilton, thank you.
To say that this crit blather to try to get into Sam's bikinis is hilarious, but I mean, Wharton is the school of business. Just the one business, not the other three.
Yeah, I just Googled it. There is a result for Wharton art history, but it's for a guy named Glenn Wharton, who's the professor of art history at UCLA and the chair of the UCLA/Getty interdepartmental program, the conservation of cultural heritage. Hey, Glenn.
I mean, I guess it's possible that Penn has like an undergrad Wharton section. The way, you know what? No one cares. It's probably bullshit. Moving on.
Billy excuses himself since he minored in phys ed and the only surprise there is that it was not his major. But Craig came by to make sure Sam was okay after he tried to date rape her the other night. Not that he puts it that way. Promises it'll never happen again. Seriously, he loves the painting and he'd like to put it in his office, and Sam gives it to him and refuses payment. Speaking of Sam's fucking art, Sydney runs into Kyle outside of their apartments, promising to deliver the new painting he wanted in a couple of days. It's that personal touch of hers that makes doing business with her so much fun, he says. And their faces get very close together as they say goodbye, but they don't kiss. And when Kyle goes inside, Taylor's performatively and poutily ignoring him. He doesn't want her sitting there feeling resentful, to which she shoots back that we don't always get what we want. He's thought about his responsibility in this fight. And clip 7.
You were right about one thing. I haven't been very trusting of you. And maybe it's because I don't trust myself.
Oh, I can't believe you're actually admitting to something.
When I had the affair, I justified it to myself. I came up with excuses for making it okay. I was thinking that you were more like me than you are.
See, then I was right. This is about your fears.
Yeah, well, partly, but it's also about chemistry. The dangerous kind that exists between certain people.
And you think that's what Peter and I have?
I'm not saying that you can't be attracted to him or anybody else for that matter, but to let that energy get too close, it creates doors, and those doors open way too easily. We almost broke up because I did that. Let's learn from my mistake, not let it happen again.
Why do I love you so damn much?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe because I'm very handsome. No, yeah, rugged. Oh, very good cook.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. The energy creates doors, and the doors open to rooms, and in the rooms, like, slow down. Guy. Yeah,
the doors of perception, and then fucking Jim Morrison starts singing about a shaman in the desert. Like, what?
Yeah.
Are you to just get to the part where you forbid her to talk to Peter, please?
Well, here it is. clip 8.
So what do you want me to do?
Promise to stay away from him. That's all I ask.
Okay. Promise.
Well, I don't know why. I just don't buy it for some reason.
Yeah, it's weird. But it is weird.
The next day, Amanda pops by Field Manor to see Arthur, who instantly seems more chill in retirement from D&D, so maybe Craig did him a favor. Mm-hmm. But Amanda, who went back to a miniskirt suit for this chat because she was not born yesterday, wants to know what happened with Craig. Arthur thinks Craig kicked him out as a typical child's rebellion. He still has a significant investment in the agency, so he wants to make sure that Craig is sufficiently reined in. Clip 9.
And what does any of this have to do with me?
As long as D&D stays afloat, I earn money and you earn a paycheck. Let's face it, Craig is no you. He's going to need someone to catch him when he falls, and I need to make sure the company saves face, Amanda. And you... Well, you would, of course, be compensated accordingly.
Let me get this straight. You're proposing that I trust and take money from the same man who, until days ago, was actively trying to oust me from my job.
It's a funny business, isn't it?
For the record, I'm completely offended by your offer. But that doesn't mean I won't accept it. I'll stay at D&D until Craig flops. But only because I intend to take his place when he does.
I would expect nothing less, Amanda.
One more thing. I'm not cheap.
Only Heather Locklear could sell that line. I'm completely true. Offended. I will do it, though.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
So Amanda meets Peter at the hospital right after his first surgery since his most recent murder charge. She wanted to be there to say, I told you so, when it all ended up being fine. And it was. In fact, it was so great that he is horny and starts coming on to her right there in the hall. But then a nurse appears to say his patient flatlined 10 minutes after surgery. Whoopsie. That kills the mood. The next day, Amanda enters her office with Billy, who is basically her shadow at D&D at this point, to see that Craig's in the middle of moving in. Her stuff's been moved into a window office in the front. And Billy oversteps by snitting that common courtesy would have caused Craig to run this by Amanda first, but then he gets distracted by workers hanging Sam's painting, and Amanda tells him to shut up anyway. And Amanda compliments the painting. Craig's like, my girlfriend gave it to me. And Billy, making the wrong face, is like, your girlfriend? And Amanda takes off, telling Craig to enjoy the space. And outside the door, which already has Craig Field President on it, Amanda crabs
in this font that's like the Hollywood Diner font. Oh God, from 1982. So, like, oh my God, props.
It's
give
so corny.
One shit.
Yeah. So Amanda crabs that it's easier to decorate an office than run a company, but Billy's still back on girlfriend. So that night, Taylor comes up from the laundry room with a full basket to see Peter sitting at a patio table drinking one beer with 5 more bottles in front of him, and pauses in surprise for a moment. Okay, yes. Go ahead.
In the show's timeline, this is the next day. You waited a whole night to drink the pain away?
Yeah. Also, she's done doing laundry, so she would have had to pass him on her way to the basement prior to this. Unless
he
just
brought all the empties out there, then performatively was drinking the last one and hoping someone would notice that he had a sad.
Right. Or he brought a 6-pack of beer, but just loose, like in his arms while she was out of sight, and then started the one. Well, whatever. Anyway.
This is dumb.
Yes, it is. Taylor asks if she may join him and then further asks why he's drinking in the dark. And he tells her about the dead patient, adding that it all reminded him of Beth because it seemed fine at first and then it wasn't. And she puts her hand on his wrist as he babbles that he should have seen it coming. She asks if Amanda's home, but he pouts that she had to work late. She breathlessly offers to make him a sandwich, but he's not hungry. She won't let him have beer for dinner and refuses to take no for an answer as she drags him up to her place, which is when Kyle comes through the gate and sees Taylor holding, oh, I guess it's to his place, sees Taylor holding Peter's arm as he staggers into his place with him. And Kyle is already at least a glass into drowning his sorrows when Taylor returns. She tries to act innocent, so he says he saw her with Peter. And I don't know why he doesn't forgive her everything once he gets an eyeful of those boobs in that sweater, because it's ribbed and they're impressive.
Yeah. Her butt is pretty good, too.
Mm-hmm.
In case Eddie was writing a book.
Mm-hmm. These are important notes. Taylor claims it was just a friendly gesture. Peter needed someone to talk to, and she wasn't going to ignore that just because Kyle was feeling insecure. Getting up furiously, Kyle reminds her that he told her how he felt, and if her promises don't mean anything, why should his? The next morning, Peter wants Michael to cover his surgery that day but can't find him, and Amanda assures Peter he'll be fine, but he spits that she said that the last time, and he's like, she asks if he's saying it was her fault, and he needs to get through this without taking it out on her. And as she walks through the courtyard, she is curt to Billy and fully ignores Sam, which is so funny.
Like, queen.
I mean, Sam's not on the lease. Like, what does she care?
Yeah.
Billy tells Sam about seeing her painting in Craig's office, and if he intends for that to make her act guilty, it does not work even a little. And he adds that Craig called Sam his girlfriend, so is that true? And Sam doesn't know, but once again says it's none of Billy's business. So, like, again, to your point from the last episode, do you want to be friends or not? Like, what is his business?
Like, why are you out in the court? Just be like, hey, everyone, get the paper, go back inside, and stop talking to these people who don't like you.
Right. So before Sam can get away from him, Billy says he forgot to say the other night that he liked her painting. He didn't understand it, but he liked it. And she takes the compliment and sidles off while he glares some more. Over to the hospital, where a gun-shy Peter walks into an OR. Matt is also there, starting his surgical rotation and looking forward to observing Peter because he's heard Peter's one of the best. But when Peter is handed the scalpel, he just awkwardly fidgets with it before setting it back on the tray and running out. And on top of everything else, as you can see in the visual aids, his mask hygiene is a mess. He's got the top ties of his mask, like, under his ears. Like, no, no, no. Your mask doesn't need to be on your neck.
Static electricity? That's not going to work.
Exactly.
And there's, like, this Twilight Zone music happening. Like, I don't get it. Jesus.
So that night, Sydney delivers the new painting as promised. And then nosily asks about Kyle being at the restaurant alone again, and he overshares that he doesn't want to sleep in the same bed as Taylor before catching himself and adding that he doesn't want to talk about anything except art. So Sydney says they need to stand 10 feet back to get the full effect of the painting, but all he apparently wants to do look at is her, and then they finally kiss. Good Lord.
Finally. It's pretty hot, too.
It's not bad. Let's close it up by naming our episode MVP. I mean, Sydney got what she wanted and got to tattle on Jane. Not a bad week.
Yeah, I'm going to go Amanda. Mm. I liked her suit styles and she got a couple sick burns in.
She did.
Yeah.
Least valuable player. Billy, what are you for?
Michael, fuck off.
Oh, yeah. Or Dan. I mean, I guess either of the controlling bastards, but I'm still going to stick on Billy because he is serving no purpose at this point.
That's true. Next time on Again With This, Kyle sets a boundary, Matt gets a warning, Samantha gets a free studio, and Peter gets depressed. Speaking of depressing, it's our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. Those are on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. And grab a spare tux out of our closet to follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and to visit our Patreon page. There's a ton of extra 90210 and Melrose content over there, including, for our subscribers at the $5 level and up, our monthly recaps of the 90210 OMG podcast. You will find all of that at patreon.com/againwiththis. I'm waste of that college degree, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is oleaginous crit feedback Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer, David T. Cole, is not cheap. Talk to you next time. Ooh.
Ooh.
What? Just mash every button.